You want the best for your child. K-12 can help them gain the skills they need to reach their full potential while giving you the support you need to get them there. K-12 powered schools are tuition-free accredited online public schools for students in kindergarten through 12th grade. Their state-certified teachers make online learning interactive and engaging, allowing your child to learn at their pace from the safety of home. Join the more than 2 million families who have chosen K-12. Go to k12.com/podcast today to learn more. That's k12.com/podcast.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com.
Are you trying to find the perfect distribution platform to get your music on Spotify and Apple? I personally use and love DistroKid. Go to mixingmusicpodcast.com/DistroKid to get a small discount and get access to a platform with unlimited uploads for a yearly fee. Happy uploading and enjoy the show. Hello and welcome back to the Mixing Music Podcast. I'm your host DK, and with me as always is my lovely co-host Large Income Lou, because that's today's topic is how today we're talking about how we have slowly increased our incomes over our careers and how you can do the same thing. Now, this is not about me and Lou specifically, but we want to give you sort of just general basic business concepts for you to consider. And then we hope that you learn something and implement something in a way where you can increase your income. Now, if you are a hobbyist mixer, this episode we will touch a little bit about how income is correlated with skill and actual what skills are important. But this is mostly for the engineer, the mixer, the producer that's trying to make an income or increase their income from various different levels, from starting at absolutely no income to even at the advanced stages, and kind of just reminding everyone of the basics. Again, this is not particularly specific financial advice for anybody, but these are more business concepts that you have to consider when you're considering your income and considering how you scale it up. And this is a big problem in our industry, because typically speaking, in any sort of creative freelance industry, it is very emotionally difficult to overcome the idea of charging your clients more money. There's a innate sense of guilt. If you are creative, then you are likely to be much more able to feel sympathy or empathy. You know, we're not sociopaths. We're not psychopaths just trying to crush everyone and not give a crap. You know, we give a crap about everybody, and we want to. And oftentimes in this industry, it's a lot of insecurity that's unnecessary, and we don't want to disappoint anybody or tell anybody, you know, give them a reason to say no. So considering all this stuff, we're going to talk about different tactics to start charging more and different ways to charge a basic income. Now, here's the thing. This is a really interesting industry, and I always joke, and because I've now made about 7 or 8 different businesses, only which about 2 or 3 stand to this day. And I have learned a lot from my failed businesses. And I've also learned that the one thing that I'm really passionate about, the most passionate about, the thing that I feel like my life calling is about mixing, is the least scalable thing that I've ever done. And I think that that is hilarious to me. Typically speaking, we can only work on one song at a time for one client at a time. And worst of all, if we're not working, we're not making money. Now, many other businesses, for example, if I sell courses, that's a much more scalable source of income. I don't ever have to directly be there. I can create, I can spend an immense amount of time and effort creating a course. Then it's all passive after that. Maybe a little bit of troubleshooting, maybe a little bit of helping people out, but it's mostly just, you know, I do it once and it goes into the wild and 100 people can buy the course overnight while I'm sleeping. That's very scalable. But with mixing, with producing, with recording, it's most of the time one client at a time. And the only way that you can scale is by, and this is the first point that we're going to make. The only way that you can typically scale within our industry is by either working faster or charging more per project.
Yeah.
There's a third way, but it involves kind of like moving a little bit, which is more management and, or in some cases, allowing offloading some work to assistants. So I basically just offloading work, which is a third way, which we'll dive into a little bit later. But let's first talk about speeding up your work or increasing your income per project, increasing your price. Lou.
Yeah.
Tell us about the basic fears that you think that you've had, that most people have had, the fear of raising prices.
I think it's a very common one, and this one should be pretty easy to catch right away. Most people are scared of losing clients at raising their price. But let's say that, you know, I've talked to a lot of people, both people that are interned for us and just friends of ours. You know, we all work in the same industry, most of our friends. But one of the biggest fears is like, well, if I go from charging $100 a song to $300 a song, only like 25% of my clientele is there, but you'd make three times as much. So you'd actually potentially walk out with 75% of your equal income with 2/3 of the work less. You know, you would actually be able to start kind of planning for more projects and actually be able to scout more artists. You'd actually be able to pitch more than you'd be executing, which is actually kind of a big thing. When you think about like how contractors work in the construction industry, if you're not quoting, you're not working. That's kind of the big idea because anybody can build the door frame for you. You can offload that level of work. Sure, in our industry, that's not always really the case. But that makes that time that you have available to quote others that much more valuable. So that at 25% loss that you might have taken, you have three times as much work or three times as much income, but you've lost 3/4 of your work. Fine. But that quarter of your time that you still have that's just dedicated to marketing at this point is probably going to bring you more clients that are willing to pay more and respect your time more because you're no longer the bottom of the barrel price point anymore. You actually have a more respectable price point. And yes, there are other engineers that charge $3,000. So $300 in comparison still looks small. But compared to the people who saw you as the $100 engineer, probably will respect you a little more and maybe take what you say in a little more in consideration too.
There you go.
Yeah.
I think, so the big point is that usually people are typically afraid of losing clients from raising their prices. Now I want to, this is actually a really good point. I think this is a very valid concern for anybody that's listening. I think that is a very universal concept. I'm going to tell you right now that is going to keep you poor to a certain degree. And we need to talk about this in the sense that there is a right time to start raising your prices and start to charge more. There's a wrong time.
And a wrong way.
And a wrong way, right? Here's a good time. And this is something that we've talked about in previous episodes. A good time to start charging more is when you have a max capacity of 20 hours a week that you can dedicate to music. You have a full-time job. You got a family. You got 20 hours a week that you can dedicate to music. You are maxed out week after week. You are barely able to squeeze in the work because you have too much stuff going on. 20 hours a week is not enough time, and you're starting to get frustrated. Honestly, you not charging more is starting to affect your family. Like, you're now that's a great time to raise your prices. You're not losing much. If you lose a few clients, that's a good thing. There are a few things that I want to talk about specifically. A bad time to change prices, obviously, is when you're only working 5 out of your 20 available hours and you're getting frustrated because you're easily frustrated, not because of anything else.
Yeah.
There are a couple things that's a bad time to start raising clients or raising prices. There's a lot of in-between stories, something that you should consider. I want to talk about something important. This is really, really important. As you know, recently I've been quoting a lot of Alex Hormozi, probably because I've been seeing his short-form content on YouTube a lot more. But This is the concept is the more income you make, the stronger your ability to say no to higher level things. So if you want to make more money, then you have to be confident enough to say no to things that are higher value. For example, in order to make $100,000, you have to say no to $80,000 things that would lead to $80,000.
Yeah.
Right? If you want to make $200,000, you have to start saying no to things that could make you $150,000. If you want to make $1 million, you have to say no to things that would make you $750,000. And 750, like, you know what I'm saying? Like, so those amounts of money without actual guaranteed results is genuinely terrifying to say no to.
Yeah.
But the more confident you become, the more you recognize the value of your time and your work, the more your ability to say no and the confidence in your ability to say no becomes. And your ability to say no is so important and has a strong correlation to your income. Now, usually income, it's not just missed opportunities where it's like, oh, I should have done this. Oftentimes, it's just you choosing the wrong activities to pursue. And this is hard to determine, but it's don't just consider missed income as missed opportunities. Also, when you say yes to something, you're going to have to say no to something else. And that's also potential missed income as well. The second thing that I want to talk about, piggybacking on Lou's comment here. Actually, there's two more things. One is that there is a direct correlation with higher level, lower maintenance clients and the higher the price it is. Typically speaking, people that are, when you charge higher prices and people that have higher budgets are typically more experienced and are more trusting of your expertise and are less micromanaging.
Oh, yeah.
Like they understand the value of passing off that portion of the work and not having to worry about it. And they also understand, like, if you charge more, there's this image that you know what you're doing probably more than the person purchasing it, which is why they're purchasing it for so much money. So honestly speaking, the most worrisome clients, the ones that cause the most hassle, the ones that ask for the most revisions, are the ones that
have the lowest budgets typically. They're not being cheap. They just may not have the highest budget yet. And because of that, they also probably don't have a system of working with teams.
Can we talk about the studio experience and how when we started lowering our prices and raising our prices and when we started saying no to smoking and stuff and how like the clients have changed? Can you talk about our specific examples, because we have a lot of specific examples only within the last 3 years.
Oh, yeah. And the funny thing is, like, a lot of people told us we would never be able to stay afloat or be able to, like, maintain the studio. Like, in fact, I had one person, rudely enough, say, like, I'd be surprised if the studio stayed alive 3 more months. And, yeah. I'm glad to say that was a year and a half ago when we cut out smoking. But with that said, the idea here is this. It's okay to turn things away. It's okay to raise your prices. It's okay to lower your prices. But in our experience, when we had smoking allowed, this is not saying anything about the smoking culture or anything, but we also did deal with a lot of people who really wanted leeway in the studio. They just assumed that smoking in the studio was just kind of a standardized thing. It wasn't something that should actually be acknowledged as like, oh, wow, you guys actually allow this. Let me be respectful about it. Some people would just ash all over the place. And that kind of spoke to the culture of what we were inviting in when we just said blanketed yes to smoking versus having people not necessarily ask for permission, but ask for if that's something we're okay with. And if we could allow it, they would just walk in and assume. And the sad part about it is that it really just kind of showed some people's personalities walking through the door, kind of like the entitlement to it. Because when we took it away, we started seeing a lot of people get really mad about it. Like as if smoking in the studio was a right. And that's what we were entertaining when we said a blanketed yes for a long time.
I mean, there was times when we were, we charged a lot more and we also had better clients during that time. Then when we experimenting with charging less, we got more work, we made a little bit less money.
Yeah. I'd argue that
we made less money. And more importantly, it was a lot more hassle.
Yeah.
Obviously we counteracted by just not allowing smoking in the studio, which made the hassle, a significant amount of the hassle go away, which was specific to our situation.
Yeah.
But it's funny, when we were charging more, we had better clients.
Yep.
We had happier clients. We could open the doors less often and have less people running the studio. So it's less costs on our end.
By a long shot.
And we had happier clients. Now, there's another thing too, is like we also went into a time where we're experimenting with giving deals. So like we oftentimes gave deals to people. Hey, you're this, our friend, so we're going to give you this percentage off. And for a while, we were the ones that like, okay, we're willing to negotiate with you on price. And that kind of became a brand of ours. What happened during that time when we were open to negotiation?
So it's kind of funny because we actually found ourselves like giving out deals to different people that were hard to track and manage. So when people were asking for a similar deal or asking for a comparative deal, there was also people talking about their deals and if one person got a better deal or not. So there would be sometimes where I get a phone call saying like, hey, I just found out that so-and-so was able to book the studio at this price. Is that like a new price or what's going on there? It's like, oh, no. No, they booked a specific deal. That was a one-off deal. Yeah, sorry, I wouldn't be able to match it, things of that nature. But the nice thing is that it kind of opened up the conversation of like, hey, if you can't afford the full rate, like come to me, talk to me, and we can figure something out. And as long as it's respectable on both ends, then we're happy to work with you. But then there were some people where they could clearly tell their hand where you actually called one of these clients out, DK. I don't know if you remember, for lying to you and to your face in front of everybody, where they called me asking me for like a deal and I said no to it. I gave you the fair warning about it, only for them to come up to you and lie to you that I had agreed to it. Where it's like, hey, these deals that we're making, obviously some people respect them, not everybody will. But the nice thing is that, you know, as long as you keep track of everything and keep people honest, like it's fine, but it's also more work to do that.
I remember that
it's
moment.
More work.
I remember that moment, and that was a pretty badass moment in my career. Because in front of everyone, he tried to lie to me. So in front of everyone, I called him out on it.
Yeah.
He said, this is not the place where you lie. I know the truth. And he shirked. He dropped his shoulders and he got a little embarrassed. And I called him in front of my entire team. Anyway, don't lie to me is the point there. I will call you out. I may be quiet in the corner, but I don't deal with bullshit. Neither should you.
Nope.
There is an interesting thing, too, is that offering discounts regularly is a very slippery slope.
It is.
Because there's this thing that happened where, like, clients started expecting a deal.
Yeah.
And then it kept getting lower and lower and lower. Yep. And then all of a sudden, they had leverage.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, well, if you don't get it lower, then I'm just going to go somewhere else.
And but my response to that has always been the same. That is fine.
Yeah. Well, I mean, when we create the opportunity to make deals in the studio scenario, it became their leverage.
Yeah.
So that's the difficult thing as well. In order to, I think it's better to be like, no, this is a set price.
Yeah.
No, like, I mean, there's a reason why like CarMax charges more per the price of used car, but like there's no negotiation.
Yeah.
There's no negotiation. They just charge slightly higher in exchange for no negotiation.
Yeah.
And people still like that.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, we know what we're getting here.
There's a guarantee of service and everything.
Yeah. So it's and that's worth it. And like nobody goes to CarMax to negotiate.
Yeah. Like one of the easiest things for me whenever those kind of situations came up was like, that deal you heard about is because they've been a regular with us for quite a while. We can talk about doing something similar for you, but we just don't offer those kind of deals on your first or second booking. We understand that there's new client deals at different studios, similar to like a dispensary. Maybe it's your first time you buy and they give you a free joint. Cool. But unfortunately, like that deal was based on relationship.
So yeah, that's the thing too. So we're not saying no to giving deals, but we are saying be aware of the potential slippery slope that giving deals does. Giving deals to one specific person is great, but like being known as the person that haggles, just like you lose all your leverage.
Yeah, it's like going to downtown LA. I never look at the price. I just ask them how much is it, and I offer them half, and then we negotiate.
And the cool thing about CarMax is that anybody that goes to CarMax or any sort of similar type of sales thing where there's no negotiation because we just set our prices slightly higher and that's just it, is that anybody that actually comes to the sales desk to purchase a car, they've already self-qualified themselves a ton.
Yeah.
So both for the salesperson and for the buyer, it's way easier. And so it's just like, okay, this is the set expectation. It's super smooth. And there are clients out there for you that are willing to potentially pay slightly more for a hassle-free experience.
Yeah.
And I think that's something that's you're considering too. Sorry, you said something about you offer half price and you haggle from there.
Yeah, that's if I don't know a place and I know that prices aren't what they promote, then I'm never going to offer you full rate.
Yeah.
There would be no reason for me to. So the cool thing is, like, when we would get people asking, like, well, how come they got a deal? Like, when people found out, because, you know, people talk. They're bound to find out whatever deal somebody else got. Cool. Like, I didn't know that, one of our recent clients brought an artist that I used to work with back at Dreamville. And when we saw each other, like, I just let him know. Like, I didn't tell him what the prices were. I just tell him, like, hey, just like your guy that booked the session, I gave him a deal because he booked for so many days in a row. But I'd love to see you around the studio. So just anytime you want to come through, just give me a call and we'll see if we can fit you in somehow. And that was the conversation. I never said, let me give you a price. I just said, let me see if I can fit you in somehow. That could be happy hour, you know? And on happy hour, we don't really discount and all that stuff unless, like, somebody's really trying to do something big. Because at that point, once again, there's no point. It's just like CarMax. There's no negotiating happy hour. But if you were buying 10 cars in a row, maybe there's some negotiation there, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But the one thing you want to remember is that there's a lot of customers that are looking for a deal. And there's a lot of clients who are there even after you raise your price. And that's what we're after. Our studio is very much client-based more than it is customer-based. Because we've been told many times over, like, hey, if you started allowing smoking and dropped your prices, you'd book more. That's true, but we just end up reverting to, you know, more hassle and more work with less, if not, at the very least, equal pay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at cenovus.com.
When you have to stop but don't really want to, stop at BP. Because BP has everything you need to keep it going. Fuel to keep the adventures going. The BP Me app to keep the savings and the commutes going. Snacks and drinks to keep the crew going. And the BP Me rewards Visa to keep the rewards going and going and going. A stop at BP isn't a stop at all. Keep it going.
So we're going to go into the next topic here, which is something that you should worry about. I remember one time when I was younger, there was a friend of mine who is in the same industry, a little bit older than me, still works in the same industry. He's still doing well. He's doing fantastic, actually. And it was at the beginning of my career, and he was wondering, DK, and this, I'm not going to use the actual prices.
Mm-hmm.
But he's like, DK, you could charge twice as much, retain half of your clients, and make the same amount of money, but for half the work.
Yeah.
And then my argument was, because this was, again, early in my career, my argument was, or I could charge half the amount, could double the clients, and yeah, I'd have to do the same amount or double the amount of work, but I also have twice as many people spreading my good name around.
Yeah.
So that's based on whether or not you have the work ethic, whether or not you're able to properly make every client happy. But in the beginning stages, I would actually recommend you work with way too many people, as long as you have the motivation, the ability to make them all happy.
Yeah.
Make as many people as happy as you can possible, because then that way you have more people spreading word of mouth. At the end of the day, everything that we do is word of mouth. People, I either seem like I know what I'm doing. People have heard that I know what I'm doing. They're friends with someone that has hired me. They think that I know what I'm doing. People hire Lou because of the podcast. They know Lou from the podcast. They know Lou from... a friend worked with Lou. They know Lou from "You Built My Studio. Can you also mix my record?" You know, like, there's so many other things. It's almost 100% of the time word of mouth. And the more people that you work with, the more people's lives that you touch, you're just scaling the word of mouth advertising that's going around. Now, there's a point where there's a threshold that's like, it's not worth sacrificing mental health, you know, and time away from family. But that's something that while you're younger, it's a lot more flexible. There's also this term in economics that I bring up a ton. This is like one of my favorite things to think about. I think that this topic is super intriguing, is the idea of elasticity. The definition of elasticity is a measure of a variable's sensitivity to a change in another variable, most commonly referring to demand as affected by other factors such as price. For example, the example that I always give is if Disney doubled their ticket prices and they lose half of their clientele, that's great elasticity. It's worth it for Disney to double their prices because they would make the same amount of money, but with half the amount of cost to run the park because there's less people coming in, higher levels of customer satisfaction because there's the lines are less big, right?
So I mean, didn't that happen in like the last 10 years? Like there was like a giant jump in their price. Yeah, everybody complained about it. Yeah, like the parking passes went up, everything went up, and everybody complained. But yeah, I still have yet to see Disney struggle.
Well, they're struggling for different reasons, but we're not going to get it. That's not for this podcast. That's a great move. And that with a company of that size, you know for a fact that there are people much smarter than I or us that are measuring out an actual number for the elasticity of the company have determined that it is worth losing this much money by raising the price this much. Okay, so what does that mean for us? I'm not going to teach you how to calculate elasticity for your business. Our business is way too small of a scale, but this is a concept that I want you to think about. It's worth losing some clients to a certain point once down the road, once you kind of done your work, you feel frustrated. Maybe the feelings of frustration are come back. Maybe that it's just time to level up. Maybe you want to explore other things. Maybe you're just trying to gain some freedom, because almost everyone who works really hard and loves their craft at some point is like, okay, I want to actually start trying to make a family, trying to get married, you know, care about my dating life. I want to, like, there's a point that you're going to be like, I can't obsess and do this for 80 hours a week, every single week. This is not sustainable. Yeah. So this is something that you're eventually going to have to think about. Maybe not so much in the early career, but eventually. There is a point where doing my friend's model, which is doubling your price, doing half the amount of clients for half the amount of work, making the same amount of money, is worth it. And that is going to be up to you and your scenario. Maybe that's you from the beginning. Right. But the point is that's something to consider as well. How much more can you charge before you lose that many amount of clientele? So if you charge only $50 more and you notice a 25% drop off, then you have to calculate, okay, like I'm making this much more money, but with this many projects, am I actually making the same amount of money? And if the answer is no, that you've probably charged too much, too early. It's probably, honestly speaking, if we're actually talking about like practical uses, you need to have a proper time frame to experiment with. Like, for example, experimenting by raising your price for 1 month is not enough of a sample. Like, it's not a big enough sample to actually create any hard data with. I would recommend doing it for a year, maybe at least a year for a bare minimum for a slow, small scale, white glove companies or companies like we have typically, wait a minimum for at least a year. And I would just hard commit, even no matter how difficult it is. There may be some months like let the experiment go out and then reconvene and rethink about it afterwards. Now, with some people that are making a lot more money and are not making enough money, so they're like really reliant on the consistency of their income, this is going to be a lot more difficult to do, but it is something to experiment with. And that's the last thing, the second thing that I want to get into, the next thing that I want to get into is the importance of experimentation. Don't just listen to me when I say stop giving away discounts. Like, try giving away discounts. See, like, run that experiment. See why, maybe consider, I may find out, fuck around and find out why I'm actually giving that advice. Or you may find out that in your case, I'm totally wrong and giving out discounts is what made you double your income. And the cool thing about what we do is that we don't work for an employer. So doubling your income year over year is so difficult, but it's not impossible. Imagine working for a big company. Mm-hmm. Doubling your income, that's unheard of. 100% wage increase, that's unheard of. But in our, as a freelancer, as someone without a boss, when we're our own boss, it is totally possible to double your income in a year. Now, I'm not going to share. I refuse to share explicitly. I don't talk about income or anything like that. But this year was, for me, one of those years. In 1 year, I doubled my income. And we're not even at the end of the year yet, which is a huge step for me. And that's actually kind of concerning for taxes point, but we're not going to get into that. What changed? I think partially I started charging a lot. I think it was the right time for me to charge more. I think I started charging a lot more. And on top of that, the word of mouth spread where I have now really consistent clients, especially during the summer months. Now, let's talk a little bit about, we talked about pricing, raising your prices, right? The second thing that I want to talk about is speed. Lou, There's times when you if you lose quality, let's talk about speed and how obviously working faster, charging. So, okay, hold on. Let me refresh. Let's talk about charging per hour and charging per project and why you should charge per project. And then also let's talk about the thresholds of when it's good to work faster and when it's good to slow down and focus on quality.
Sure.
Is that cool?
Yeah. Let's start with slowing down, because I feel like a lot of times people don't want to talk about slowing down. They want to talk about doing more. How fast can I crank out 50 projects, right? Sometimes the goal isn't 50 projects, but rather focusing on the quality output of what you're working on. For instance, a good example of this would be like mastering. Yeah, a lot of people look at mastering as just like, just get it loud or just get it to translate. Just don't change the mix as much as you can. But there's so many little things that you could do with the compressor that actually throws off the mix, that even if you could master the song in 30 minutes, you know, maybe give it another 30 minutes. Maybe just take a listen to it before you send it back, because just by trying to work too fast, you might have cut yourself off on quality. And if you're not double checking yourself, if you're not giving yourself a fresh set of ears the next day to listen to it before sending it off and things of that nature, just like little backup checks, you might lose your opportunity to book that client again. So sometimes working too fast might get you to bite yourself in the butt. If you're just trying to work fast, just to work fast, at that point, you should slow down and try to make sure that you can manage your quality output.
Now, this is interesting because that's the thing. So you're sacrificing quality for speed is something that you should try to avoid at all times.
Exactly.
Now, I will say that for every customer, for almost every sector, for almost any scenario, whether you're hiring a mixer or you're hiring someone to build your deck or whatever, the thing that customers want most is for whoever they're hiring to solve their problem with the least amount of friction.
Yeah.
Now, if you can keep that friction really low with high speed, that's good on you.
Yep.
And when you charge per project, you're motivated to become more efficient. And that's better for both parties. When you charge per hour, then the motivation is to just do the work no matter how long it takes. In fact, you might slow down on purpose, which doesn't necessarily. So it's like, people might feel cheated. It gets a little bit confusing.
Yeah.
When you charge per project, then there's a mutual motivation to be efficient and be strong. And it encourages you to be better at what you do. Instead of charging per hour, where it doesn't encourage you to be better or anything like that. There are benefits to charging per hour, but we won't get into it. Okay, so you're talking about quality and lower quality. So with customers, the only thing that they want is less friction to solve a problem.
Yeah.
Now, people are willing to pay significantly more for less and less friction.
Yep.
For example, if it's $200 for a mix, but they got to work with you every single step of the way, you're probably not going to do a good first or second or third draft. And it's going to be like four or five drafts before you finally get it right. I feel like you get it right. You're not really good at communicating. I don't know when you're going to get it done. You're just unreliable.
Yeah.
Versus the person that's $500, who's going to get it right in the first revision or two. Mm-hmm. Who's going to get the first couple mixes, who is always communicating with you with the progress of their work.
Yep.
Who is always super kind on the phone, always picks up their phone, always answers their texts.
Oh, yeah.
How much is that communication and lack of friction worth?
A lot.
You know, from 200 to 500 bucks, that's like, it's crazy how much it's worth.
Yeah.
So I think that's what you're talking about, right? When you need to slow down in order to make sure that there's less and less friction from the customer.
Yeah. Let's say that you can master an album in a day. Sure. That is possible. But if you're trying to do two albums a day, just because you're trying to double up your income, you could have, what we talked about before, raised your price so that you can dedicate more time to it, have, you know, the same, income level with less output, I guess. But realistically speaking, if you're going to be just rushing through albums just to knock them out, just trying to expand your income and everything, and you start noticing, oh shit, I forgot to master this one song. I missed this one. And details start falling through the cracks. You're going to start running into some issues, and your client's not really going to appreciate that. And they're likely to just maybe give somebody else an opportunity. Maybe not outright just let you go, but they might give somebody an opportunity who's not having these details fall through the cracks. You know, and that's where slowing down is a big important thing. Like you, it's okay to try to move faster and try to create systems. Try some new systems, implement them little by little, but just, you know, black and white outright, just going into, we're going to double up now. You might find yourself losing opportunities.
I will say that for 4 out of 5 times, maybe 9 out of 10 times, right? If there's friction, it's going to be because you suck as a human being and you need to be a better adult. You need to use a calendar. You need to have a to-do list. You need to use software or ways to to figure out project management and how to deal with it. You need to stay organized. 9 out of 10 times, it's because you suck as being an adult. I mean, it's everything's working against you. You're a creative person in a creative industry. Creative people aren't the most organized people in the world, but you're going to have to be. If you want to charge more, you're going to have to be organized. If you want to remove friction, you're going to have to be organized. That being said, 1 out of 10 people or 1 out of 5 people, you know, that like 10 to 20%, whatever. Sometimes you need to charge more in order to get to stop dropping the ball and to stop losing those details. I'm not going to give anyone that's listening to this podcast the excuse that it's because you're not charging enough. But some people, there is going to be a threshold that you need to determine on your own whether or not it's worth charging more, losing some clients for the purpose of, because you want to have a more frictionless operation.
Yeah.
Most people created friction because they're just stupid.
Yeah.
And not really willing, not stupid, sorry. Immature. But if you are trying your best to be mature, you're just overwhelmed, then the 10 to 20% of you that might be in that scenario, you might have to start charging more and kind of lose some clients in order to stop dropping the ball. Because if you drop the ball, that's costing you every single time. You know, losing the small details.
There is a curveball that we can add here.
What's that?
You might need to drop a specific client.
Ooh.
Yeah, let's be honest. Not every client is exactly the same. Most clients typically want the same service and trust you just as equally as the next. But sometimes you have one client like, here's a good example of where raising your price and slowing down would be a good idea. I had a client that reached out to me saying that they really enjoyed my work. They're looking for a personal engineer, somebody who can really help them find their sound and dial in what their parts have been wanting for a long time. Cool. Whatever that means. But I could tell from reading the message that in the email, it sounded really, really needy. Really time consuming. So at that point, you know, I didn't even want to offer a per hour, which in those kind of cases, like sometimes a upfront minimum plus hourly is a good idea. But what I ended up doing is telling him, hey, typically charge X amount for a mix. For something of this nature, for the level of attentiveness that you're communicating that you're going to need and the amount of sessions and the fact that you want to be in person every time I'm working, I'm going to charge you 4 times the amount. And I just put in the message saying, I know this might sound like a shock, but typically speaking with my roster of clients, they trust me to do my job on my own and I can work at my own hours as long as I hit my deadlines and the expectations. In this case, it sounds like you're still looking to find somebody who you can build trust in. I may not be the best bet for you if you don't already have some level of trust with me.
That's true. And on the opposite end, there's the idea that like, I just don't like some clients as well. Like if this person is a totally fine person, but they just piss me off for whatever reason, it's still worth saying no. Even if they're not the problem, you know, you're the problem. No money is worth potentially giving someone a bad impression and potentially having one person start spreading bad word of mouth.
Yeah. I'm sure you've had clients that have a pretty high count of revision requests, not because of the quality of the work, but out of insecurity. That's another one too, where it's like, it's not necessarily that like doing a lot of revisions is a bad thing, but at a certain point you have certain clients that require a lot more work to do the same work, but not because of necessarily, and I'm not saying to think of yourself as like almighty and all knowing, but sometimes some revisions are really just reproducing the song at which point that's not mixing anymore. And you have to be able to like define those lines with your clients.
Yeah. And actually, I'm going to get into this in a moment, but I just asked ChatGPT, how can I politely decline continuing work with a client?
Be prompt is the first one.
And actually, this is a really great list. And I'm going to explain it why in a moment here. But this is a real case scenario. If you are someone that is constantly feel like you're having bad clients or bad customer experience, I'm going to tell you right now, like, you're not, if you work with 100 clients, you're not going to win all of them. Yeah. Like, you're not going to win all of them. But if you are losing more than, let's say, this is a generalized statement. If you have bad experience, if 5% of your customers have a bad experience, that is way more. That is way too much. Way too much. 1% should be closer to the number. So if you work with 100 people and 5 of them don't have a good time with you, there might be, or more, usually significantly more. If it's significantly more than that, I would deem that it's something wrong with you. And this is the reason why that's hard, because here's the thing. Let's say you work with someone, they're unhappy, you get prideful, and it's like, well, it's because they got bad taste. I'm sorry to tell you, it's probably you and your customer service. Like, at the end of the day, we hear this all the time, but I don't think people really acknowledge or understand what this means. We work in the service industry.
Yep.
What that means is that you're not there to sell a product. You're not there to be like, here is this Allen wrench that you needed to solve your problem. You are working with them, step by step, holding their hand along the way to provide a service. Like a server at a restaurant, you're not just giving them the food, you're ensuring that they're having a good time. That's what that means.
Have you ever had a server tell you, don't get the chicken?
There you go. But I'm serious though. So like, I think that obviously we get into pockets, but I want to say that I'm just really sick and tired of people that are like, why is everything happening to me? Like, I just continue to have the bad clients. I continue to have, that is the most narcissistic, like, holy crap, that is so narcissistic. You need to tone that back. If you consistently have unhappy clients, it's fucking you, okay?
Yeah.
It's fucking you. And so you need to either change that or you need to kind of like, and here's the thing, the cool thing about being a bad service provider is that it's really easy to turn that around. Like, it's totally up to you. It's your fault. You can change it. It's totally up to you. And within a day, you can start having happier clients, because it's usually just a decision that you need to make and a commitment. Okay. That being said, like, it's usually not people don't know what to do. It's usually, you know what to do. You just don't want to do the hard and simple thing. Okay. Anyway, sorry, getting on a tangent. I'm a big proponent of solving you. First. But let's talk about this ChatGPT thing and why this is actually a really great list. Sometimes you're going to have to politely decline work. You don't want to give yourself the opportunity to fuck up. You don't want to give them the opportunity to dislike your work. I don't usually do metal music. So if someone offers me a song to mix a metal song, I'm likely to just say like, nah, here's someone else that I know. I'm going to help them finish their project. I'm going to be on their team, but I'm probably going to refuse to, because one, I have other work that makes me, we're not going to get into that. But because I know I'm not going to be able to make them as happy as somebody else. I think somebody else might do a better job. I might make some income off the top, which is a third thing with like more management, right? If I pass the work to Lou, I'm going to be like, hey, Lou, I'm taking 10 to 20% of your view charge. Let's say, just for the sake of argument here, like, you charge $100 for the mix, which is not how much you charge per mixing. You charge $100, you know, just give me like 15, 20 bucks. And I'll give you 80 because I found this client for you. That's like really rational. For management, 10 to 20%, somewhere in between, depending on the relationship. 20% is a little bit high. Depending on the relationship and the consistency, all that stuff. That's pretty normal. And it's not weird as long as you bring it up front. Okay, when you're saying no to a client, here's some things to take care of, things to consider from the language modeled in artificial intelligence here. So number one is be prompt. Address the situation as soon as you made the decision. Avoid delaying, as it's respectful to give clients time to find an alternative solution. This is huge, especially when talking about money. If you've made a decision, it's hard to have that uncomfortable conversation. It is very, even for someone who is an assertive asshole like myself, it is never easy or fun to have the conversation, the confrontational conversation that I don't want to work with you. I mean, we've also had to fire. I've had to fire many people in the past for various different positions. It's never fun. That's life. Who gives a shit? That's life.
Yeah.
You've had to have uncomfortable situations where, you know, I mean, you try your best not to say no, right? I know you've talked about that. You try your best not to say no.
Yeah.
But does it ever help to delay having that conversation, that difficult conversation?
No.
Have you ever had, I'm trying to think right now. I'm going to put you on the spot. Have you ever had a specific instance where delaying a conversation led to a worse outcome than just having that conversation earlier?
Hell yeah. Hell yeah. Especially when finances are involved.
Oof.
Which is kind of the big topic today.
Can you off the top of your head think of a specific scenario? Because I mean, the answer is obvious for me too.
Yeah. Yeah. So I took on there was a pretty good streak for me where I was getting hired pretty back to back for a bunch of things to the point where I had a total of like 30 songs on my list of like songs I needed to mix and master.
Heavy yeah. workload.
Yeah. And that was all for 1 month. So like that's a song a day, which is, you know, similar to like when you did your 1,000 songs and stuff, you were doing like 3 a day at that point. But I didn't have assistants. I had an assistant, but like he was just kind of going through like a burnout phase at the time. And so it was one of those things where as much as I could keep track of it, I was starting to notice that like the projects that were due later in the month were starting to like evidently going to be delayed. And so the ones that got closer, there was one that I reached out to the guy like a week before a deadline. And I was like, hey, I don't think I can do this. Like, is there any chance that we can like push the deadline a week, or what's the hard deadline? He's like, no, I had to get it to the label that day I told you. I was like, crap. So I ended up having to like put everything else I could to the side. I had a bunch of clients where I'm like, hey, can I move your project back? Move your project back? Like trying to find a window of opportunity. Didn't find it. Ended up refunding them. Never got that client back.
Oof.
Yeah. So it was one of those where it's like, I should have seen, I guess, the crack that had the little things fallen through. And yeah. Didn't see that. Lost the client for that.
Dang.
Yeah. I should have just set a cap to how much work I can do. Instead of just accepting all the work that I can do. And all of it was like paid full rate, you know? So it's not like there was maybe like one client that was getting like a special price. So at that point, it's like everybody should have gotten equal quality treatment.
I mean, I won't get into the details of this situation, but I often talk about the time where in a former dishonorably discharged assistant of mine.
Dishonorably discharged assistant.
Assistant of mine.
A DDA.
Received multiple death threats.
Yeah.
Because they did not have a conversation about money promptly. They delayed it. And they had that conversation at the end of the at the end of the project. That's not cool. Being prompt is respectful. You're showing honor. You're showing respect. You're not there to waste their time. You're willing to do the hard thing. Even if it is difficult, you're taking responsibility, which is always the right move. Choosing the right medium is number two. So it's like doing in-person interaction, going over the phone. Breaking up with a girlfriend over text is not the right medium.
No, it never is.
So something similar within that vein, we can go over that. Number three, express gratitude. You know, you value the person. You're not trying to disrespect them. Hey,
like, I thank
this
you
has
for
been
the opportunity.
Fun. Yeah, there it is. Number four, keep it brief. This is, and number five, or six is explain if necessary. I actually disagree with this one. I don't think you should ever explain. I think that you should avoid explaining. Take this from the scene of Moneyball. If you've ever seen the movie Moneyball, and it's like, these are professionals, like just state that they're moving to a different team, that they're fired or they're being replaced, and that's it. No conversation. This is more. That's more important, like in a firing situation.
And that's more on a very corporate level.
Yeah, that's So, but I mean, if it's a professional, but the problem with stating explaining if necessary, and that's the even ChatGPT is like if necessary. The problem with explaining is that you potentially are creating an opportunity to dig a deeper hole and to become, because what if they're just untrustworthy. And you're like, you're just untrustworthy. You know, like, how are you going to explain yourself out of that one? Like, oh, like, you just suck as a human being. I really don't like you. You know, like, it's hard to eloquently articulate that, you know?
You know, I'm not going to lie. I would rather hear that than not know. I would, there's,
as
I would
say. As the person receiving that, that's true.
Yeah, as the person receiving the decline, I would actually respectfully like to know why there's decline. And I'm a big overshare, evidently, if anybody knows me.
Yeah, we both are.
But the funny thing is this. I'm a big believer in, like, I need to know because I don't play the guessing game. If I feel like something's off and I ask about it, I just want to know. That's it. I won't take it personally. So if I'm talking to a client and I say, hey, I can't work with you anymore, it's probably best if we have that conversation. And even if I had to explain the reasoning, if there's a fault on my end that I have to accept, then I'll accept my fault. But I also don't want there to be any gray area in the conversation of, oh, why is this an issue?
Yeah.
You know, that way, if you would like to amend things, if that's something you're into, I'm into it in the future. But at this moment in time, I'm okay for now. I think what we need is a break at the very least. But right now, I just can't provide this service for you.
There you go. So keep it brief, state your decision, and sticking to your decision. What's weaker than saying no is saying changing your mind back to a yes after originally stating no.
Yeah, at which point a no in the future doesn't hold any weight.
You're just continuing a relationship that's doomed to fail at that point. Just say no, no matter what excuses they use, no matter how much they apologize, just say no, whatever. Totally case by case dependent, but typically speaking, stick to your decision. That being said, like, don't rush your decision. Like, if this is probably you have this conversation after you've thought about it, you've talked to somebody, maybe a mentor, explained the situation, you know, whatever. Apologize if appropriate. I think that this happens all the time. Like, people apologize far too often. I mean, we are the service provider, so, it's okay to lean on the idea that, you know, you probably should apologize just in case to cover your bases, you know. But most of the time, don't apologize. Don't worry about it. Offer assistance. Yeah, never leave them hanging. That's a really great idea. Like, if you're like, hey, I'm unable to do this now, but I have a buddy that's willing to do this for whatever you're willing to. Like, if the problem is pricing, they're not like, they want me to lower my price.
If it's time, they have more time.
They have more time, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
You offer a solution. That is really important.
Yeah.
Because they just want the problem to be solved. And granted, as much as you are important to their lives, and I'm sure that there's lots of times where you have the leverage because you're so damn cool, right? They want to work with you specifically, which is often the case in the mixing and mastering world. It's very personal. It's a personal decision. You don't just switch barbers.
Yeah. You know, yeah, like, that's not a thing.
So with the offer assistance, like, comfortably and offering somebody else that can solve their problems efficiently and, again, trying to remove that friction because they just want a problem solved with the least amount of friction possible.
Yeah. So what's kind of funny is I currently do this with the venue that I do front of house for. I'm the only one that knows that venue through and through. So I've talked many times with the owner. We've kind of agreed to different things, and we're going to be starting like a lesson program where not necessarily to find new assistants, but so that, for instance, we now have two consoles, a split snake, this and that. I've now tasked Henry, who assists me for these concerts, to be monitor world. So now he's getting more hands-on with the console and more dedicated to like, hey, I need you to route the monitors. I need you to handle the feedback and everything, like putting more responsibility into other people's hands and actually like having a training system for anytime we onboard anybody to work with us to get them actual dedicated one-on-one time with the console. Reason being is because I want to go on vacation and we have a concert every single weekend. How do I leave with the venue not having somebody to rely on that they know and trust, knows the venue well enough and can execute everything they usually ask for?
Yeah.
Yeah. Creating systems sometimes is your best friend, but if part of those systems is you being gone for a little bit, you need to have better training in place.
That's true. I mean, one person might think, oh, you're removing your leverage. You had a monopoly on the knowledge of how to run the venue. Why would you give them the opportunity to hire you out?
Because I want to get the fuck outside.
Yeah, you want, that's true. Like, there's going to be a threshold where you're like, oh, I want to go on a vacation.
Yeah, I want to take, you know, a nice little, what are they called? You get on a boat for a week, a voyage, whatever. But still,
a cruise. Oh, I thought you were being kidding.
I really forgot. But like we talked about it, like we went to a wedding this weekend and one of the family members told us like, hey, you know, seriously, you guys didn't do a bachelor or bachelorette party. Like, why don't we plan one? Why don't we take a cruise or something? And, you know, I thought about it. I'm like, that would be nice just to get away for a little bit because I've been talking about it. Still haven't gone on vacation or honeymoon or anything. But when you find yourself in a situation where you can't actually provide the service that you're kind of known for in the time that you're gone, you kind of need to start having people that you can refer them to in the meantime, even if it's just temporarily, or have assistance and things of that nature. But, you know, if you're finding yourself in a situation where you're saying no to a project because you just don't have time, then it's time to find ways to have time, raise your prices, lower client count, less work. In my case right now, it's very much like I'm not trying to lose the client. So that might be part of your factoring. It's like you're not necessarily trying to lose
anybody.
Yeah,
that's a weird way to word it. Yeah. Not, you're not trying to like get rid of your clients, but you are trying to
find time away from your clients.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is okay. They will understand if they don't have any pressing projects. But if you have projects that they need done and you say, hey, I can't take it on at this time, then you can explain yourself. You can say, hey, I'm actually going on a honeymoon. They might wait for you.
Yeah.
But if they're not willing to wait, then yeah, definitely. You should still hold your ground in that you're leaving on vacation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, so let's kind of go over our 3 points. One, charging per project versus charging per hour. If you are tracking, charging per hour will protect you over if they extend the sessions. It protects you if they decide to go longer or change the schedule. That's how it protects you. With producing, it can protect you if it ends up taking longer. So charging per hour will protect you from people that want to take advantage of you or end up, the project doesn't go well, so they actually need to take significantly longer than originally planned. Charge per hour, that protects you. The problem with charging per hour is that there's no motivation. Their motivation is to work. It's not to make a good product. Their motivation, the client's motivation, is to get the most amount of work from you fast as possible. And your motivation is to take as long as possible.
Yep.
So there's no motivation to do better. There's motivation just do things fast for them and do things slow for you. When you charge per project, hopefully you charge enough to incorporate the potential accidental extension of a project or the, you know, the revisions or whatever. You need to charge enough to incorporate the potential losses of a project or two out of every, you know, out of a dozen that goes a little bit longer than normal.
Yeah.
But that being said, it motivates the client to have the best product possible, and then it motivates you to become efficient and to be good at your job. So it encourages and forces you to become better at your job, which is a great motivating factor when charging your stuff. Also, when you charge per project, it is significantly more scalable because the better you become, the faster you become, then the more money you make per hour. If it takes you 10 hours to finish a 100-hour project, you know, you make $10 per hour. If you can do the same project with the same quality, and even potentially even removing more friction, you can do it for 5 hours, learn to do 5 hours. You just doubled your income, $20 per hour for the same project. And that's 100% based on what's under your responsibility, what's under your domain. It's 100% how much you get paid per hour is 100% in your control rather than per hour. That's not in your control. It's totally out of your control. It works well for employees, but it's hard for self-employment. I would recommend charging per project. We've talked about this. The only people that should be charging per hour consistently in the studio is like the tracking engineer. That's like a pretty consistent thing.
Yeah.
Cause like per project is a little bit weird and it can always go longer.
You can agree to a salary and an hour cap. So you can say, this is my salary for X amount of hours on call the whole time, whether you use those hours or not. But if we go past those hours, we revert into an hourly on top of my salary.
Yeah. Okay. So there's a good point too. Another thing that we always recommend is that if you're a tracking engineer that also offers mixing. So for example, if you track and charge $25 an hour for tracking, for recording, I would highly suggest that you do not mix for a project price. It's very difficult to do. Imagine working with me or spending time in the studio. Hey, can you just mix the song real quick? Oh, that's a separate price. So you're saying no to doing it right now. We're already in the studio. It becomes really convoluted. So I would actually recommend, if you are trying to charge per project, stop tracking or stop offering any sort of hourly project. Just completely move to per song. If you offer both, move to per song. I will do the tracking for the song, and you can even limit it up to 8 hours max, and mixing for $250 or whatever price that you determine, right? That's going to be way smoother. Again, removes friction. If you are and I get a lot of DMs about this, so I'm just going to be really clear. If you, again, offer tracking per hour, you either you offer mixing for continuation of the session per hour, or just don't even charge them for the mixing and just part of the engineering. Okay, or you charge per project. It's really messy, sticky, bad situation to like charge hourly for recording and charge per song for mixing. There's a lot of people that have been able to successfully do that, but that's just a messy situation that can create a lot of unnecessary, difficult conversations. So that's just a pro tip from us. Another thing that we talked about is working faster. The only two ways that you can do it, one of the two main ways to increase your income is by working faster, which is skill-based. It's also efficiency-based. It's about project management. It's about responding to emails, maybe setting boundaries and setting limits to your work hours.
Creating systems,
automating different things. That's huge, right? And second thing is by charging more per project. And we talked about those things. The third thing that I want to briefly touch on, which is not the main point of this, is management or passing things on, taking a cut for somebody else doing the work and become the person that finds the work. Now, this happens later on in the career. It's almost like an inevitable transition eventually for most people. If you're way too busy, like Lou was talking about, Lou, you always talk about this on this show. You try your very best to never say no to anybody.
Yeah.
You say, I can't do this, but I know someone else who can.
Yeah.
And try to pass it off.
A good example of this was finishing up the Zeus project. Like, I had to miss out on a couple episodes.
Zeus is a studio that he was building recently.
Yeah, so the Zeus Network does TV shows on, like, Blueface, Mayweather, Krishan Rock, and all that kind of stuff. And they've blown up a lot in the last couple of years.
So while you were building the studio.
Yeah, basically, I found myself early on. It was funny because you even asked me, you're like, Lou, are you even working on the project? I'm like, yep, everything's been delegated. But towards, like, the last month, 2 months of the project, that's when like things got really fast and like quick pace, because it's like we're on site, we have a deadline to hit, we're assembling everything, all the pieces have been ordered, everything's arrived, but I'm still getting requests for like mixing and mastering and recording sessions. And I'm telling people, like, if you can wait a month, I can take it on. But unless you can do that, unfortunately, I'm not in a position to be able to accept the work right now. So also understanding your workload is kind of like a big thing, being able to say no because you're just a little too busy. And I don't want to say no. I want to find a solution. So instead of stating the problem, the solution may be, hey, what's your deadline? If it's a month out from now, I can take it on, but I can't take it on right now if it's like a 1 week turnaround because I just have too much on my plate. But I do know people who may be able to do that. You know, so offering solutions is kind of my goal.
That's a huge thing. And the cool thing about that is that you can monetize the solutions that you offer.
Oh, yeah.
Make sure you talk to them beforehand. Hey, I'm going to give you a client. Is it cool if I take a 10% cut? I'm going to charge them, being really honest and open with them. I told them you charge $200. I know you typically charge $150. I'm just going to take $50 off the top. If you're cool, if you're just down or whatever, you don't always have to tell them.
But to be honest, that's something that's on a pretty regular basis higher up. I remember once quoting something that I would do when I was asked by an A&R how much I charge, only to tell the you know executive that I was working with that day. He's like, oh, you didn't tell him price, right? I was like, I did. Why? He's like, how much did you tell him? I was like, I told him $300. He's like, you realize my commission would have been more than that, right? I was like, no, I didn't know that. But yeah, sometimes it's like tough. It's pretty normal the higher up you go, where you know these guys, they don't want to do all the work, but they also want to be able to monetize all the opportunities they're giving out. So it's actually pretty common culture to see people like, hey, I've got a mixer that can do it. He normally charges 2,000, and the commission the other guy might take is $500.
You know? And dude, I'm gonna tell you right now, it's really, for everybody, it's really difficult to see the value of their own work for most people.
Yeah,
it's like people are like, okay, you should be charging $400, but currently I'm only charging $200 per song or whatever.
Yeah.
Those are our numbers made up. If someone negotiated on my behalf, this is the great thing about a manager. They're like, DK does fantastic work. He charges $400 per song.
Mm-hmm.
And let's say I take more than 20%. I take $100. I take 25% out of the $400. You still make $300. You know how happy that would make you?
Yeah.
Like if I offered that to you, if you were charging those rates. So it's also a great way to build relationships, to kind of throw out good karma into the world. And it's a way to scale. And then that's, again, you're just passing off a project and making income from it. So it's just real. That's like infinitely scalable.
Yeah.
So it's, if you are in a position where you are taking on too much work, or if you do have to say no to someone, I don't recommend just passing it off. I do recommend being in the habit of taking a small percentage off the top as an expectation. You want to build that expectation from the beginning if you do pass it off.
Just offering yourself as a resource for a line of communication in case there's some miscommunication happening.
Yeah.
Like, it's like, oh, I keep telling them about that thing you do for me normally. Like, I'm having a hard time telling them. It's like, all right, cool. No worries. I'll still talk to them. Because even when you become available or their budget opens up a little more, you're still top of mind.
There you go. It's also kind of like, I hate to bring this up, but it's also like a very kind and honorable thing to do as like a power play, in the sense that like, if you do them a favor, they're going to feel like they owe you a favor, and people don't like to owe other people's favors. So if you just force them by like, okay, no, I'm going to do this for you, but you owe me something in return, then it'll actually be like a balanced power play. It's like, okay, I don't owe you anything. You don't owe me anything. This is kind of like fair. So it's actually like, I encourage you to do that. It's fair all around.
Yeah.
You're just giving them free work and they have the opportunity to say no, right? And if they don't want to do it, they can say no. Okay. Last thing that I want to bring up before we end this episode is, don't discount your services. Couple reasons. One, discounts either basically are just announcing to the world that I don't have enough work right now, and that's never a good look. You never ever want to seem desperate for work. That's another bad thing, you know.
And a powerful and lastly, use of the word no.
Yeah, yeah. And lastly, discounts, lower prices, obviously, we've talked about, lead to worse clients, more higher maintenance clients. But it also, again, sets the wrong expectation. It gives the client leverage. But I have a solution instead of offering discounts.
Mm-hmm.
I have a solution.
Offer an exchange in value.
Exactly. Offer more. Offer more. This is the first thing that you should consider. Instead of charging a discount, you're charging a discount partially in the early stages is probably because you feel bad because you don't feel like your skill equals the amount that you're charging. Like it's a personal internal struggle that you're having. Like, I don't feel like my work deserves this much money, so I'm going to give you a discount just so you can be happy. It's usually in the attempts of appeasing the client. Here's the deal. That is the unhealthiest, worst way to think about it. They're going to be less likely to be happy. I know that goes against logic, but they're going to be less likely to be happy. You're going to be unhappy as well. And you're never going to be able to get over that personal problem that you don't feel like you're good enough. The way that you should work is that you should stick to your price, but you should offer double the amount. For example, if you offer a $300 mix, and it's like, okay, I didn't tune the vocals as much as you thought I would. I'm going to charge, okay, you know what? For this project, I'm only going to give you $200 for it. Like, you down negotiate yourself. They didn't even ask for it. You just negotiate yourself down, which is stupid. Don't do that. Instead of that, the only way to become confident with how much you charge when you charge more is by offering more. If I charge $300, I'm going to give you a fucking $500 to $600 worth of service that I believe is worth $500, $600. And I'm going to do my very best. So by the time that I charge you $300, I'm going to feel more than worthy of receiving that $300. It's a psychological thing you should do for yourself. It's also going to make the clients happy. So that's the trick. Never ever give discounts, because what you're doing is half-assing the work. You're giving yourself an excuse to half-ass the work. What you're not doing when you charge, when you give more than service, is allowing yourself any sort of leeway in your ability to execute. So again, if you charge $300, give them a $500 to $600 service. They're going to be happy. You're going to feel like you're going to have a clean conscience. You're going to feel like you earned that shit, and it's going to make you more money over the long run. That's like a huge piece of advice that I learned from, partially from The Go-Giver, that book that I always highly recommend that anybody who's doing what we do should read, The Go-Giver. Anyway, any last thoughts, Lou? How did you feel about that last thing? I mean, you brought it up as well, but. Do you remember in the early years giving discounts due to like some sort of like insecurity on your end?
Yeah, a lot of times it's kind of funny. So the first time I actually started recording with Keisha was because I actually was called to help reset up her studio. Apparently the last engineer that set it up just really did a bad job on it. But she asked me how much I charge for a recording. I'm like, hey, for new clients, just to do like one session where we just kind of get to know each other. I understand cost is always a factor. I'll typically charge $35 an hour for the first session. After that, if you like working with me, I charge $50 an hour. She's like, oh, I don't care about paying your full rate on the first session. That doesn't matter. And I was in my head, I was like, it's not every day you hear that. It's not every day. And after that, I never offered it again.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the funny thing is, like, on a certain level, it's partly you doubting yourself.
It is. It shows
it's you
doubt.
Doubting yourself.
It shows self-doubt.
Where it's like, well, I don't want you to feel like you paid too much if you didn't like me. So I'll discount the first one. After that, you know the value, you know? But it's like, yo, out the gate, I'm not trying to sound like a douche, but I know I'm him. I know. And I have no doubt about it. And so because of that, my price reflects it. And everybody that I've worked with, well, I'm not going to say everybody. There's that one percenter. But I've never had such a bad experience that somebody's ever been like, fuck this guy, Lou. I've never had, like, the worst experience I've ever had is like, you know what? I messed up on the deadline. Let me offer a discount on my price because I fucked up. Not because the quality is any different, but it's because something that I committed to, I didn't hit the mark on. So because of that, I'm going to try to compensate.
Yeah.
But there is no discounting because I'm incompetent.
Yeah.
There is no such thing as that.
But I remember in the early days of my career, I would do that all the time. I'd be like, either from the beginning, it's like, hey, I usually do this much, but I'm only going to do this much because internally, I'm thinking because I haven't had a client in a while, I need this extra work and because I don't feel like I deserve it.
You know, the funny thing is it actually has a really bad display on new clients because if you're willing to take a discount right away, it does actually look like you need work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's I mean, we're so not going to get into supply, demand, basic economics.
But like realistically, if you need work and you hold your price and you say, I'm sorry, I just can't take it for less, that also says something about yourself and how well you're going to do in the future. Because honestly speaking, if they think that you need more work, they probably look at you with a different sense now too.
They're much more likely to take advantage of you, even if it's not on purpose.
Even then, they might just question the quality of the work.
There you go.
It's like, why isn't he getting booked more? So it's when you hold your price and say like, you're obviously not communicating your schedule, you're just saying your price. But if they're negotiating your price, it's like, well, you know, if you do like two songs, three songs, like we can talk about it. Nowadays, I don't discount unless it's an album.
Yeah.
Like, give me the whole album and we can negotiate.
Yeah. And the last note that I want to end on is the cool thing with all of this is that skill obviously is correlated to making more per hour if you charge per project.
Yeah.
But something that also, and that's like with time, with practice, the more that you do, the better you're going to get. That's not necessarily in your control. What is in your control is removing friction, being on top of your shit, not letting things slide, not letting projects fall between the cracks, responding to emails quickly, responding to text messages, telling people no, telling people yes, being a mature human being, someone that doesn't get upset, someone's able to control their anger, someone that is understands their position in their role in the project, you know, and provides a good service. And that takes nothing other than a decision.
Yeah.
There's some skill there, but that is mostly a decision that has always been available to you and will always be available to you. And that alone can increase your income significantly. So the good news, and this is where I want to end it with, is that with increasing your income, skill will come, but your maturity and your dedication to the craft, your customer service is worth its weight in gold. And can compensate where you feel like you may be lacking in skill. So it's a huge thing. Most people don't go far enough with their customer service. Even the smart kids, when put into group project, one person's going to do all the work. All you have to do is just be a little bit better than everybody else, and you're going to win a lot of clients. Just a little bit. It's so easy to do well. It's so easy.
And it literally usually has less to do with your quality of output.
Exactly. Yeah. We learned that this week. We watched a YouTube video where a dude compared a $700 mix versus a $1,000 mix versus a $400 mix versus for $70 mix.
Yeah.
You know who did the worst? Was that $700 mix.
Yep.
Someone was charging $700 and was worse, almost worse than that $70 mix.
Yeah.
It was insane. But again, how is he able to do that? It's probably because of reputation as well as, you know, the astounding amount of confidence. It's crazy.
Yeah.
But the point is like also probably just like flexibility and ease of service. Even with someone like Dale Becker for Becca Mastery,
yeah.
Part of the reason why these labels hire him so often is because, I mean, having worked with them, like giving him the files, receiving the files, scheduling in a master, the invoicing is so fucking flawless.
Yeah.
It's so smooth. It's insane. It kind of makes me feel bad. I need to revamp my services. Anyway, that's for a conversation for a different time. Anyway, thank you so much for watching. We hope that, or listening, if you are a fan of the pod and you want to, you know, do us the kind service of leaving a 5-star review, we highly appreciate that. We see the numbers going up every single week. That helps us so much. So if you're watching on YouTube, subscribe, give the thumbs up, whatever. If you're on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, whatever other Spreaker, you know, Podbean, whatever you're listening to, please leave 5-star review, leave a couple kind words. We see those. We see your comments. We love those. We might even give you a shout out, but also that does help us significantly. So, and lastly, if you are interested in our exclusive episodes where we talk about exclusive episodes, we talk about technical skills, mixing techniques, mastering techniques, producing techniques, and we break down other tips from other engineers, Grammy-winning, award-winning influencers or engineers, and we break it down into easy-to-digest information for you to practically be better at your mixing, so the skill portion of it. If you're interested in that, go to mixingmusicpodcast.com/exclusive to sign up for the exclusive content. We release two exclusive episodes every single week for $4 a month or $40 a year. So once again, go to masonmusicpodcast.com/exclusive. And on that note, we hope you the best business ever. We hope that we wish you the best of luck to increase your income year over year and to go full time if that's what you're trying to do. We wish you the best of luck. Happy mixing, my friends, and stay saucy.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at cenovus.com. Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at cenovus.com.